Hello everyone, welcome to episode 62 of TNS. Now today, I have a very inspiring conversation for you all, but before I give a little brief introduction as to the chat that follows, I just want to give a few plugs like I do at the start of every episode. So firstly, if you enjoy listening to TNS and you have an iPhone, then if you could go over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a nice review, it really helps us grow in the charts and get our message out to as many people as possible, which is of course the aim of TNS. And secondly, make sure you go and check out our blog as well. Got a lot of content up there at the moment. So that's www.tnsblog.com. And if you feel like writing a piece for TNS, don't hesitate to get in touch. Always looking for people to write pieces for the blog. So it's more than welcome if that's something that you would like to do. Now, as for today's episode, episode 62, I was joined by Catherine Cracknell for this. So Catherine originally studied drama at university and went on to work for the National Youth Theatre, in fact. But while she was there, she decided to return to university to pursue her ambition of becoming a midwife. While training in midwifery at the Uni of Bedfordshire, she contracted cancer, sepsis, and suffered from a collapsed lung. Despite this, Catherine completed her course and graduated in 2015. She now works at Ipswich Hospital as a specialist midwife. So a really inspiring conversation that follows. Catherine is a fantastic guest. So much positivity, so much enlightenment, honestly. It's a fantastic convo. In the first half, we talk more about the process of making these life-changing decisions, going from drama to becoming a midwife. It's a drastic change. And in the second half, we talk about the difficulties that she faced. She had to go through a lot, but she still graduated from university. And honestly, it's just amazing to hear. So without further ado, I bring you today's conversation. So how are you doing today, Catherine?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you so much for finding the time to come on the show. I know that your story is incredibly inspiring, and I know that my audience will learn a lot from this conversation. I don't want to give too much away at the start, but I guess the first thing we want to talk about is you originally at university studied drama, didn't you, before a drastic change in career path, which we will talk about later. But you studied drama to start with. Was that from a, did you have a love of drama from a young age?
I did. And I think when I was 18, I had dreams that I would end up on the stage, be an actress. And because I am quite academic, I thought a lot of pressure from teachers, although that was all just me supposing that wasn't actually there, that I needed to take their subject at GCSE and A level and then follow that through and reach my absolute potential. But when I was looking at universities, I was interested in psychology, but then I realized university, you have to really self-motivate. The teachers don't care if you don't get the grade. You are the one that has to do the work. And I thought, right, let's do something that I actually love. So that's why I chose drama. And I had a ball, for 3 years. And yes, I got a degree out of it. But for me, my first degree was more about learning how to be an adult, learning how to function by myself and self-motivate, rather than thinking this is it, this is the career path that I've chosen for the rest of my life. I made friends who are still an integral part of my life now. I have those friends. I can't imagine my life without those friends. And I think the things like that is what I took from my first degree. Yes, I got a grade, and I think many jobs on applications, they want to see that you can study to that level, that you can study to a degree level. And there are only a few professions where it actually matters what that degree is in, what the subject is. So yeah, that's why I did drama and I loved it. I did not become an actress.
I think you've touched on some really, really important points there. And I think the thing that I tried to say to people who are looking to go to uni, you know, it's not about the work. That's not the thing that I took from university either. I didn't come out and think, oh God, I love the work so much. You know, I don't want to be a historian. But you learn to grow up there. You learn a bit about who you are. I think, you know, living with friends, that's the first time you do it. Properly living away from home, you grow up pretty fast, don't you? I think, did you find when you started living with friends that you really grew up sort of overnight?
Absolutely. And I learned that there are friends that you can live with and there are friends who you are friends with because you choose the time that you spend with them.
Exactly.
Yes. I have, because I did university twice, I have lived with a lot of people, and there are some friends who I am very good friends with because I don't live with them. Mm-hmm. I tried that. No, it doesn't work.
Sometimes you have sort of clash of personalities or with tidying up. I think that's one thing that you don't realize before you start living with people. But yeah, you have friends where you know it's sort of you're in harmony and living together is easy. It might not even necessarily be your best friend. You're able to live with them. And some of your best friends, it doesn't quite work out as well, does it?
No.
You studied drama. You loved it. Clearly, you know, you chose a thing you wanted to do. And you went on to work for the National Youth Theatre, I believe.
I did. So when I left university, I went back home and I was a teaching assistant just because my mum was a teacher and I was able, like I knew a bit about that. And then an opportunity came for me to live in London with one of my friends from uni, and I'd saved some money and I thought, right, I'll go. I was a member of the National Youth Theatre. I'd done that when I was in university, and I just wrote to them on a whim. I was like, I'm in London for 3 months. I will come, like, stuff letters. I will do anything. And that's what I did. I was an intern initially, and I posted all the rejection letters, and I was like, I'm sorry. You're still worthy, as I was putting them in the envelopes and sending them off. And then I was offered an internship to work on their like outreach programs. So not the main season that they do, which then produces the actors like Daniel Craig and things like that. This is like the outreach, the localized work that they do. And then I then applied for a job as what was I called? A youth worker or something like that. So I did the administration and a little bit of teaching on their access to higher education program, which was called Playing Up. And it was for young people, not in education, employment or training. Lots of these young people lived in hostels, really vulnerable young people. And they didn't have any qualifications, and we got them the equivalent of A-levels. And the year, so I was in London for 3 months. I actually ended up staying nearly 3 years. And the year that I did that, every single one of my children, all the people that did it the year that I, they all qualified, and every single one of them had an application to university, drama school, or a job at the end of it. Even one of our boys, he had type 1 diabetes and he died very soon to the end of the course, about a month before the course ended. He lived in a youth hostel. He had a hypo and nobody found him. It was just tragic. He got that qualification posthumously when someone has died?
Posthumously. Yeah,
he got the qualification. And I think when we went to the funeral, his family spoke about how much change that had happened in that last year. So I'm immensely proud of the work that I did at National Youth Theatre and the work that they do. But I think, I don't know, 6 months into that year, I was like, I need a job. I need a career. And I didn't feel that doing that was my career. I didn't feel, I loved living in London, but I didn't feel settled there. I couldn't imagine myself years in the future settling there. So I decided I needed a real job. And I was having a conversation with a friend who was training to be a midwife. And I thought, oh, I could do that. Yeah. I think I could do that. Yeah. And that's where that's literally where my interest started. Lots of my family are medical. My brother is a nurse. My aunt's a nurse. My stepmom's a nurse. My stepsister is a radiographer. So lots of us are in the medical field. I'm not brave enough to be a nurse. I can't cope with ill people. I'm not clever enough. But I was listening to my friend talk about midwifery and the changes that happen to a woman's body while they're pregnant. And I was like, oh, that's incredible. I want to do that. Yeah. So that's...
Right. Yeah. I was going to ask, where did the desire come from to have such a change from, you know, working in theatre to becoming a midwife, because that is a completely different career. There's not much linking the two, I suppose. I don't know, maybe caring for others, like you said, part of your job was to care for these vulnerable youths. Possibly there's a link there.
I think that is a common thread throughout my life. When I was at universities, I was on all the committees as freshers rep, listening to people. When I did that job in the theatre, it was very much supporting people. And as I've qualified and become a midwife, that has sort of been the path that my life has followed, like supporting people. And I think it was that really interested me. I am clever. I'm not putting myself down, but I am not I'm not medically minded. Maths scares me. I know what I need to do in science to do my job. I know about biology that I need for my job. But I couldn't be a doctor. I really don't think I could be a nurse. I can't. They know so much about how the human body goes wrong that I don't know. Because pregnant women, usually, touch wood, are well women who need medical assistance having a baby. If that makes sense, rather than they're ill. I think it was just a world that I hadn't really heard a lot about. And my friend was telling me this, and she was so passionate about it and fascinated about it. And I thought, it just really appealed to me. I was like, I think I could do that.
I mean, I think you are putting yourself down slightly just before we're saying that maybe, you know, you couldn't be a nurse. I'm sure you could just talking to you briefly now. But do you think your skill lies in emotional intelligence? Do you think that is real skill then? Yeah.
Yeah. And when I finished my midwifery degree, my mum was like, right, no more studying because I'm a terrible procrastinator. If you know anything about personality types, I am a perceiver rather than a judger. I work furiously for the 3 days before an essay is due in, even though I had 3 months to do it. So Mama said, no more studying, but I started working as a midwife and I was like, I want to learn something new. So I did a counselling course.
Wow.
Yeah, so I've done... 2 years of counselling skills and studies, and I love midwifery, and I love looking after women in labour and delivering babies. There's nothing that compares to it, but it's the whole raw, like when you're looking after a woman, you're not looking after her in that moment. You're looking like she is a whole person. We're talking about giving holistic care, the whole person. She has emotional, social needs that I believe midwives have a really important, they can put a really important part into that. They can they've got an impact there that they can make. And that is what really speaks to me. Yeah.
That's incredible. Genuinely, it's so admirable doing that. Such an important role to play in something that obviously many women have to go through at some point. Most women have to go through at some point. So it's a very important role to play, definitely. And you said that you moved out of London. So did you, where did you move back to midwife?
When I was applying, because midwifery is one of those things, you do have to have a degree in midwifery to be a midwife. So I applied back home in Ipswich. I applied to a London university as well, because I thought my housemate might kill me if I didn't at least try. And then my sister was training to be a teacher at the University of Bedfordshire. And that's why I chose those three universities to apply to. The University of Bedfordshire offered me an interview. And I went down there and I got a really nice feel about the place. The lecturers were really, really nice. I am the worst applicant ever, because I was being driven down there. I was like, oh, I probably should have been prepared for this interview. Oh, they're going to ask me questions, aren't they? Oh. And my first question was, I'm a community midwife. What do you think I do? And I was like, you look after women who are having babies. She's like, yes, and? I was like, you look after women who have had babies. Yes, and? Like, oh! So, miraculously, I got a place. And I was actually looking to have a year out, do my gap year, which I'd never done at 18. But they offered me to start then, like that September. And I thought, I'm not going to look a gift horse in the mouth. This is obviously, Ipswich and London didn't even offer me an interview. I think they were probably too thrown by the fact that I'd done a drama degree.
And
I hadn't wanted to, because when you write a personal statement, you write about how passionate you are about something, and quite often it's like, I've wanted to do this since I was a child. Well, I hadn't. And I think I was like, right, I've got this opportunity. I'm going to take it. I've got to take it. And I started, and I moved to Luton, which is where my course was situated, because the University of Bedfordshire is in Bedford and in Luton. And I suddenly couldn't breathe. And so I had all my health concerns, which is probably a bit of a spoiler, isn't it, for what we're going to talk about later. But I had to take an interrupt. So I actually joined the year which I had initially applied for. So it all comes together in the end, doesn't it?
Oh, it's incredible. And just touching back on that, desire to change a career path and mm-hmm. do something. I just think we need to reiterate that to the audience, because a lot of people feel like you do a degree and you get sort of pigeonholed in a certain area and you're sort of expected to go into that area, but that's just not true. And this is why what you're saying is so important, because you did something completely different. Not even connected in any way, really.
No, that's it. And I think, like, I didn't really consider it to be anything like that, like particularly special or anything, but that is quite a change. It is a change. What I would like people to like really think about and hold on to is the decisions you make at seventeen, probably, when you're applying to university, they do not have to define your whole life. And just make a decision that feels right at that moment with the information that you have at that moment, and do it, and try not to look back at things with regret, because you're looking back at them with new information. So you may make a different decision now, And I think I got a little bit of, that's a Mickey Mouse degree, isn't it? Why on earth do you want a drama degree? What are you going to do with that? Well, I do use the things that I learned about myself on my drama degree every single day. I really do. And people who, my friends who I did my course with, they have become teachers. My best friend's a nurse. They work in accountancy. They work in administration. It does not have to define you. There are doing my drama degree means that I could write a 3,000 word essay about the lighting and staging of a play. I can make conversation with anybody as a consequence, and that is very useful as a midwife.
I'm sure it is. Yeah, I'm sure it is.
Do you know what I mean? It's
those aspects that you don't think about with your degree. It's not the work itself. It's not the content necessarily. It's the skills that can be adapted to different walks of life. And I think you said that, you put that really, really quite beautifully, I think. And I just want my audience to really think about that. That's why I just wanted to reiterate that point, because it's so important, you know, at the age when you're at uni, you leave uni, you do get terrified of this one path, but it's just not the case anymore. And it's really important that we all remember that.
At 18, I could not be a midwife. As an 18, there are some 18-year-olds who are incredibly mature and level-headed and have experienced enough to become a midwife. That was not me at 18. I needed to be that bit older to be able to understand the complexity of humans to become a midwife. Mm-hmm. And there were two men, actually. I was going to say women on my course, but there were two men. There were people on my course who had full careers, and they were changing their career at 45. So there is no limitation. There's no age limit where you can change your mind about what you want to do. Absolutely.
And that is just so very important that people take that on board from this moment on, if they haven't already. And I just wanted to move this on to what you just mentioned, which is just before what you mentioned, which was, you've not just had this career change and then worked hard, you also had a lot of other issues that you had to deal with, which would usually derail most people, I think nearly everyone, and that's why it's so incredible that it didn't. And I suppose, could you just illuminate the health issues that you faced whilst completing your second degree in midwifery?
Yes, so I moved to Luton, and then I suddenly couldn't breathe. And I had numerous visits to the doctor, and they told me I had a cold, chest infection. So I had antibiotics and steroids. I think I had about 8 courses of those over 9 months. I also had my gallbladder removed because I had gallstones. One morning I woke up with terrible, terrible chest pain, and I phoned 111 because I was supposed to be going into work. They called me an ambulance because I think they thought I was having a heart attack or something. I was taken into hospital, and my lung had collapsed. My lung had collapsed because I had a tumour growing in my lung. I've got a type of cancer called neuroendocrine cancer. It's incredibly rare. So I had a tumor in my left lung, where it splits off to the two lobes, so it was just closing any air going through to my left lobe, the lower part. I finished really being able to go into university probably about the May time. And then I had lots of investigations, one of which meant that afterwards I got sepsis, because if you're lungs are not inflated, they get infected. And one of the investigations that I had a camera go past the tumor to try and see how big it was for surgery. And it sort of let the infection escape into my system. So I had a week in hospital with sepsis. Oh, that was great fun. I hallucinated all sorts of things. Yeah. I had visions that my granddad was sitting on my chest. But I was laying in state. Oh, I couldn't move. I had the worst headache ever. And they were giving me codeine for my headache. I'm allergic to codeine, it turns out. It gives me a really bad headache. So as soon as they stopped giving me pain relief and just gave me the antibiotics, I got over it. So I had a week in hospital with sepsis. And then in the September, so it was on my mum's birthday. Oh, bless her. I had a lobectomy. So I had probably, I don't know, a third of my left lung removed. And so I've got a little Nemo lung on the left-hand side. And then it was just recovering from that. And I returned back to my studies at a point where the year below me had reached when I left. So that's what I did.
That is just honestly incredible. genuinely, that is incredible. It's so inspiring, and to just go back, I mean, you sort of made it seem like, yeah, I just went back to my studies after and joined back. But did you ever have like a time during this whole process when you were thinking, I'm not going back? Or were you always like, no, I'm going to finish my degree?
That's a really interesting question. I think I always knew I was going to go back. My university lecturers were really like, we want you back. You need to come back to us. We will ensure that you get back on the course. Because of course, if you take an interrupt, I didn't have a choice. I needed to have major surgery and I couldn't lift up a kettle for 3 months afterwards. Like, cause I couldn't wait there. If you take an interrupt, there is not a guarantee that you'll have a place next year, because they might not have a space on the course. They may not have space in the hospitals for you to do your placements. But I knew that they were fighting for me. So I wanted to go back. And so neuroendocrine cancer is incurable. And I had 7 years of no tumours. And then at the beginning of this year, I found out that it's back. So I've got tumours now, or metastases in my bone, thyroid and liver. And in my lymph node, I found out on Monday. So it's something that I've got to live with. And I think at the beginning of this year, I had a real moment because I'd had 7 years of going to scans, all clear, nothing's there, but we're not going to discharge you because there's a chance that it could come back. And then I got this letter which told me that they'd found these metastases on a scan. And I was like, well, what's the point of me doing anything then? Like, because I'm single, I don't have children. I thought, well, there's no point in me ever thinking about any of that, because I'm going to die. Well, we're all going to die. So I've had some counselling. I've had some time to really think about it and process it. And when you hear the words cancer, you think that that's a sentence. And when you hear incurable cancer, incurable does not mean terminal. And even if it did mean terminal, you are living until you are dead. Mm-hmm. So I think... it didn't really cross my mind not to go back to university, because I was like, well, I've got to get rid of this and then I've got to live my life, because my life is going to be longer than this 9 months that I'm not in university recovering from this surgery. So that's a very long-winded way of saying, no, I hadn't really considered that I wouldn't go back to my degree. I I think I've got the mentality of a bit more longer term, like I not to to try and make like control my reaction to information that I'm getting now, and not make massive decisions that mean that that will have consequences in the long term. Does that make sense? I still thought I could be a midwife. I still thought I had that I wanted a job, a career that I loved. So I was always going to go back to university, always. And by the time that, like the, I think I went back in the April or the May, the time that that came round, I was itching to get back there. And of course I had moments where I thought, oh, I don't know if I can remember how to do this. It's muscle memory. Yeah. It's like riding a bike. You never forget. Yeah. So, yeah.
Do you feel like you are a different person after what's happened? As in, your outlook, you just mentioned your outlook, thinking long term, is that something that happened after, or were you like that before this whole process of having to deal with incurable cancer?
I think it is something that is continuously evolving. I think it is something that's that I have to keep engaging with, keep processing, because every day I don't wake up thinking I've got to think about long term. Some days I wake up and think I've got an incurable cancer. I'm just going to lay in bed today and I just want to like wallow in it. So it's a conversation I'm always having, and I talk quite openly about it. I think my colleagues and my friends get are sometimes a little bit offended about how blasé I am about talking about it, because death and cancer are horrible words to hear, and people have a reaction to it because they've had their own relationship with it. They know somebody or like somebody very, very close to them. And when when I joke about it, that's how I cope with it. Like, I remember we were in handover one day and the coordinating midwife was like, oh, I just feel rotten, I've got such a bad cold. And I went, well, you haven't got cancer, have you? To joke, to absolutely joke. And it, like, it, and I can imagine for some people that was like, oh, for goodness sake, that's just
how do you respond?
Just a joke to make. Yeah. But that's what I needed to do to, like, just process how I was feeling in that moment. Yeah.
And I think quite a few people do that as well. I mean, I know, you know, I lost my mum 2 years ago. So I understand the grief process. Lost one of my dear friends to cancer recently as well. Sometimes laughing and joking, whilst it seems to other people to sort of be irrational, it's actually perfectly rational, because it's how do you quantify things that you can't quantify. There is no way of understanding it. So making jokes makes it bearable in the short term.
Yeah, it certainly made it bearable for me. And like I said, there are some days where I don't want to joke about it. And of course, when you say something, other people will have a reaction to that. So it's allowing them to have their reaction as well. Like anytime I get any news, any scan results or anything like that, I have this moment where I'm like, if I start telling people, I then have to, then I open myself up to what their reaction is going to be. And if I'm not in a place to be able to do that, they don't need to know for now. They don't need to know at this moment, because I need to, because some people are very tactless in the way that they respond to things. Thankfully, I have not encountered any tact, but I'm thinking about other, like, for example, in my job, I encounter some very, very sad things, like losses of babies. You wouldn't believe the things that people say, trying to make the situation better, which is completely tactless. Well, at least you can get pregnant. Oh, gosh, no, absolutely not. Oh, people say things like that. Well, you can try again. Oh, okay, yeah, sure, thanks. So, is it the responsibility of the person going through the tragedy, going through the hard thing, to prepare for people's reactions? No, it probably isn't, but we are all flawed human beings who sometimes speak before we think. I have learned that I need to make sure that I am ready to deal with how people are going to react to my news. That is just something that I've learned. Yeah.
I think you touched on a really important point there as well, which is, people being a bit tactless and trying to provide a remedy for a situation that doesn't have one. And I think that's really important for people listening as well. Like sometimes with these, really horrific situations, you mentioned grief, cancer, just diseases, issues that really affect a human being to their core. Don't make the situation better. Just listen, just sit and say, I'm going to listen if you want to talk. And don't try and provide a solution because there is no solution.
the researcher Brené Brown, who I absolutely have a woman crush on, I want to be that lady when I'm a grown up. She does this incredible, she's got this incredible video about the difference between empathy and sympathy. And we don't like sitting with people who are upset. It makes us feel uncomfortable to witness that. So quite often we go in with sympathy, whereas sympathy can absolutely kill a relationship. What we actually need is empathy. It is feeling somebody's pain as if it were your own, not trying to make it right. So when somebody says, I've got cancer, or for example, I've lost my baby, you do not say, at least, no empathetic, empathetic sentence starts with at least. It just doesn't. If the first thing that comes into your head is a sentence that starts with at least, just think for more. If in doubt, say, I don't know what to say. Just say that.
I think one thing that's important with empathy and sympathy, so again, such an important differentiation there. I think empathy comes from really going through a difficult situation and absorbing it. I don't mean just having sort of lived through a difficult situation, but really taking it on board and feeling the pain, the helplessness that you may feel, so that when you're talking to other people in a similar situation, you genuinely understand, not this distraction. And like, again, I'm going to just talk about, when I lost my mum for like a year and a half, it was just distraction. And then, it was changing that to really just feeling pretty rubbish at the best of times. And then that's really, in the long term, just provided me with the skill set to be empathetic, really be there. So it's feeling the pain from situations. I mean, I don't know if you agree with that, but
it's so important that we can feel our emotions and we can name our emotions. I had some scan results on Monday, and my mum brought me some flowers in the evening, and I went, oh, cancer flowers. It's awful, horrible joke. I'm a wicked, wicked person. I know I am. She says, I just want you to be happy. And I was like, I am happy, Mum. But this is sad and this is scary and it's all right. I can be all right and be sad at the same time. Those two truths can exist together. I can be sad about this. I can take a moment to feel it and still be all right. Because if we don't feel our emotions, then we feel shame about them. Because our emotions don't get a message whether this is. What we do is we look around at people's situations and we use their situations to either validate our reason for feeling how we do, or to chastise ourselves for feeling that. So we go, well, I can, and I felt that we were doing this a lot at the start of this coronavirus thing. People were like, well, I can't feel scared and anxious about this because I'm not ill and that person is ill. At least I'm not that. So I, oh, you're pathetic and you're silly for feeling anxious. Or I could go, I've got cancer. No, what on earth have you all got to think about? Because I've got cancer. Yes, I'm valid. I am valid to feel scared and anxious about this. But our emotions don't work like that. Our emotions don't get a little message. Do-do-do-do-do. Yes, you have met the criteria. You can feel this emotion. You feel the emotion anyway. And if you try not to, you bury it. And then it just manifests. It gets gross like my lung did, ugh, underneath the surface, and then you bring the watering can of shame over it and it just festers because you feel shame about it and it just populates, and then at some point you will explode from it. You will. So it's really important to feel it in that moment. What does this feel like? But really, really try and resource yourself to be able to live through it. So is that resource, I'm going to just distract myself, I'm going to put something on TV and I'm going to just turn my brain off, just watch something that's on TV. Do you need to sleep properly? Do you physically need to move your body and get some of this energy out to be able to continue living your life? Because everybody is worthy of living a fulfilling life even when terrible things are happening to them. And I think quite a lot of it is they feel shame about how they're feeling. So, and they feel that they've got no agency in it. They've got no control over it. So they just feel it and get lost in it. Control the things that you can control. You can control what you eat. You can control when you sleep, and you can control how you move your body. Do those things right, and you will start to realize that life continues. Yeah. There's not half thoughts there. I hope I've made some sort of sense in there. I don't know.
Genuinely incredible. I mean, I'm just taking this all on board for myself, because I mean, it's just, you're putting it so, so beautifully again, like these things, keeping it simple. What can you control in your life? It's usually very simple things, isn't it? It doesn't have to be especially difficult. But yeah, honestly, Catherine, just everything that you've said today, it's just so inspiring. I mean, I am genuinely so moved by your story. I just think it's so, so incredible. Not only, you know, changing degrees and career paths to something completely unconnected, but also having to deal with these very real human issues, having to deal with contracting cancer, and that is, you know, to keep having the drive to keep going, to keep moving forward in whatever way that could be, that is so inspiring. I know everyone listening to this conversation will be so inspired. So honestly, thank you so, so much for coming on with me today to have this conversation.
It's my pleasure. I just want a last thought is, you don't have to have something as impactful as cancer to be able to make a difference. Sometimes what you may think is a really trivial thing compared to cancer actually could change somebody else's life. So I don't want anybody, like, I don't think I'm inspiring at all. What, like, I didn't do anything. The doctors took my lung out. Like, they, like, all I had to do was sit and heal. Like, I don't want people to think, oh, well, I haven't had this earth-shattering moment. I can't make an impact in the world. Absolutely you can. Everything that you say, everything that you do has an impact on the world.
That is a really that's a beautiful way to end the conversation. That's it. Everyone can have that impact. Catherine, thank you so much for coming on with me today.
My pleasure.
I hope you found that conversation as inspiring as I did. I really thought Catherine was just showed so much positivity. It's very similar to an episode that we did with Sam Fitzsimmons in our catalogue. Faced with a really difficult situation, but just showing what a positive mindset can do in those circumstances. I know this chat was a bit longer today, but I thought it merited that. I thought there was just so much wisdom that came through. So I really hope that you found that chat to be inspiring and to show that we can overcome incredibly difficult situations, but that we can give a lot to the world, even if we don't go through something as difficult as Catherine did. But make sure to get in touch with Catherine. I'll be tagging her and stuff on Instagram. And obviously on that note, make sure that you check us out on our social media channels. Instagram is thenakedstudent_, Twitter is @TNSpodcasts, and we also have a Facebook page, which is just The Naked Student. So you can find us on all of those platforms. I'll be back in the next couple of days with a new episode. So until then, keep doing what you're doing, guys.